From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US Supreme Court strikes down a Massachusetts law that created pro-life buffer zones around abortion clinics.
This buffer rule was put in place in Massachusetts in order to protect and shield people from being shouted at and in some cases physically pushed, people who had the right to protection.
Also today, the deadly Ebola virus in Africa claims a record number of victims as authorities struggle to contain the outbreak. And the ethnic Ukrainians living in America optimistic their homeland can rise out of the unrest.
What I hope for all Ukrainians and my family that lives in Ukraine is that they get to live in a civilized, democratic society.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. As chaos continues in Iraq, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says he's betting on help from Russia and Belarus to push back against Sunni insurgents. Both countries are sending jets. Around 100 American military advisors are also in Iraq, but President Barack Obama has held back from offering support in combat or airstrikes. Mr. Maliki told the BBC he wanted to purchase jets from the U.S., but that the process was long-winded, so Iraq has turned to other countries for assistance. The Australian government has announced that the hunt for missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 is moving to a new area south of where an intensive search effort failed to find a trace of the plane. Arthur Stevens reports from Melbourne.
The search for missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 will shift south along a narrow arc which has been identified as the most likely resting place of the plane. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Warren Truss says this new area was checked for wreckage earlier, but the search will now go underwater. Mr. Truss says an expert group has reviewed all existing information and the new area, covering up to 60,000 square kilometres in the southern Indian Ocean, is now regarded as the aircraft's most likely final resting place.
The World Health Organization is warning that drastic action is necessary to halt the spread of Ebola throughout West Africa. The deadly virus is responsible for around 400 fatalities so far. The large outbreak has spread throughout Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The FIFA World Cup in Brazil is amping up America's interest in the sport. The nation was captivated by today's U.S.-Germany match. Germany won, but both teams advanced to the next round of play. U.S. fans are the largest foreign ticket holders, and TV audiences are rising, as Washington correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
Last Sunday's World Cup tie between Portugal and the U.S. saw the total TV audience on English and Spanish networks hit 24.7 million viewers. For the English network ESPN, the match was the most viewed in their history, aside from their screenings of NFL and college American football games. It's a clear sign of soccer's rising ability to compete in the American psyche. The key question going forward is whether this will rub off on the National Soccer League, which has struggled to gain momentum.
Meanwhile, Uruguayan soccer player Luis Suarez has been suspended from participating in the rest of the World Cup after biting a fellow athlete during the Uruguay-Italy match. Authorities have banned Suarez for 9 matches and 4 months from all soccer activity organized by FIFA and have hit him with a fine of $112,000. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The United Nations Drugs Agency has expressed concern over the fact that a growing number of Americans are using cannabis. This comes as 2 U.S. states, Colorado and Washington, have made it legal for anyone over the age of 21 to use the drug. Mary McCarthy reports from Denver, Colorado.
The UN Office on Drugs and Crime's World Drugs Report says the rising use of cannabis in the U.S. is a public health concern, in particular because the potency of the drug appears to have increased. Data collected in the U.S. shows that emergency room visits due to marijuana use have risen, including the number of children who test positive for the drug. Meanwhile, advocates say cannabis is significantly less harmful than alcohol. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
Former BBC DJ and television presenter Jimmy Savile sexually abused victims between the ages of 5 and 75 in National Health Service hospitals over decades, according to an investigation by the British government. The report shows that Jimmy Savile had unrestricted access to patients who he sexually assaulted in their beds, in corridors, and in offices. and that he also abused visitors and staff. Our UK correspondent Natalie Feary reports.
The British Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt apologised on behalf of the government and the NHS, saying victims were let down badly and that there was a deep sense of revulsion at the findings. The investigation found that 60 people came forward with offences ranging from inappropriate remarks to sexual assault and rape. The report covered 28 hospitals and showed that poor systems to protect patients and deal with complaints allowed Savile to continue for years. Jimmy Savile died in 2011, aged 84, and a year before sexual abuse allegations were broadcast in a documentary said to have spanned 50 years. Natalie Feary, London.
For the rest of today's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story or check out our new website at featurestorynews.com. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today at the US Supreme Court, which has struck down a Massachusetts law that created so-called buffer zones around abortion clinics to push back pro-life demonstrators. While the ruling will allow protesters to speak on public streets and sidewalks, laws will continue to prevent people from blocking patients' access to abortion facilities. The Massachusetts law, enacted in 2007, created a 35-foot fixed buffer zone. Alice Olstein discussed the ruling with CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women, Nancy K. Kaufman.
The guarantee of free speech is not absolute, and they were allowed to protest. They just couldn't get so close that they could be harassing and bullying people who are at a very emotional point in their lives going to make into a clinic. To overturn a state law that allowed not to eliminate free speech, but just for a buffer around the clinic that would allow for the protection of women's health and safety, it's very shocking to us.
So you are from Massachusetts, and so you understand what's at stake here very personally. Can you talk to us about why the state had this law in the first place?
I remember very, very vividly when there was the horrific shooting outside the clinic in Brookline, Massachusetts, the abortion clinic. An opponent of abortion murdered two female staff members and wounded about five other people. And the police was in favor of upholding buffer zones to facilitate the protection. This was for the protection of clinic patients. They were harassed. They were verbally harassed and sometimes physically harassed as they just were walking into a clinic. This buffer rule was put in place in Massachusetts in order to protect and shield people from being shouted at and in some cases physically pushed, people who had the right to protection.
So do you think states, what will they have to do now in order to meet this sort of new vague standard?
It'll be implemented. Obviously, it's the Supreme Court. They've ruled, and you're going to see a situation that's going to be very dangerous, I'm afraid to say, and very unpleasant for people seeking medical care. Now, there's going to be a shorter buffer zone, which means they're going to be in your face. And I just think that creates a potentially very volatile situation.
And how does this fit into the overall picture of abortion rights right now, where it seems the strategy of the protesters has not been to get an outright ban, but to have all of these little different restrictions here and there and sort of erode it in that way?
Yeah, well, I think we're all very, very, very concerned about all the little erosions could end up adding up to a large challenge to Roe v. Wade. And that is, I think, the most frightening piece, that what happened in 1973 with Roe v. Wade could be potentially overturned in the future. And that would be a very sad day for women's rights and women's reproductive rights in this country. And there's an attack on women and on our rights as women and our freedom, and quite frankly, our freedom of religion, as well as our freedom of health care access. So it's a very, very frightening, and no one should we need to understand this as a very serious situation that is a defeat for women's health and safety.
We're expecting the Supreme Court to rule on Monday about insurance coverage of contraception. And the people who brought the case were arguing that they believe that these things are themselves like an abortion. So what could the implications of Monday's case be?
Monday's case is huge. I mean, first of all, the Affordable Care Act is being put at risk because it states that contraception won't be provided no matter where. And I think the implications of this one are huge, because does that mean that if a Jehovah Witness owns a business, they can say, sorry, we're not going to allow prescription drugs to be part of your health care? I mean, where does this end? And I think that is a very, very serious situation. They're not asking the owners of Hobby Lobby to be providing contraception to anyone. They came up with an accommodation so that the insurance, you know, third-party insurance companies would provide the benefit to people, and it didn't even have to be done through the employer. So if this case goes down the way we're all fearful it's going to, it has enormous implications.
By targeting the insurance coverage, it really comes down to an issue of cost, and those who have enough money can get whatever they need out of pocket, and those who don't have to rely on things like insurance. Is that sort of a growing problem across the board?
Yes. We're developing a two-class system. You know, that what middle-class person who's paying for insurance, doesn't think we're already paying for the insurance through our employer. And so then if you're going to be told, well, you can get insurance for the employer, but you can't get insurance for these things. So for those things, you're going to have to go and buy your own, even though you were paying for insurance. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's a very, very short-sighted decision if that's what happens, and I just hope it doesn't happen.
Alice Olstein talking to CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women, Nancy K. Kaufman. This is FSN Reports. The worst Ebola outbreak on record. That's how the World Health Organization has assessed the ongoing deadly spread of the virus in Africa. Nearly 400 people have now died in the outbreak in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia, a toll far greater than the 280 killed in that region in 1976. The WHO is planning a crisis meeting to thrash out a plan to arrest the outbreak and bring the fatality rate under control. Donna Patterson is an associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College.
I think one of the main reasons that we've seen a spike in the past few days is that the doctors and the other medical professionals in West Africa have had a lot of trouble containing this outbreak of Ebola in West Africa. And I think one of those reasons is because it's the first time that they've ever had this type of outbreak in the region.
So can you explain a bit about how this is being transmitted? And I suppose because it's not just limited to Guinea, is it? I mean, suggesting that there's fairly porous borders in that region.
Absolutely. I think that's a major issue. It's really, you know, it started at borders, and now it's most of the places are near borders. So right now there are confirmed cases in Guinea, also in Sierra Leone. It's at borders near Mali, right next to Guinea-Bissau, and then you have other countries that are very close, Cote d'Ivoire and Senegal, and so that's definitely led to the spread in the region. Also, I think in terms of this issue of porous borders, we really have to look at air travel. There have been cases that have been confirmed in Conakry, which is the capital of Guinea. It's very close to some of the other capitals in the region, and so this is a major issue, not only in terms of regional transmission, but also international transmission, because Conakry, there are international flights that go outside of Africa. If it spreads maybe to Bamako, Mali, or Dakar, Senegal, you know, there are even more flights because Senegal is very connected, in fact, to most of the continents in the world. And so definitely they need to go ahead and try to contain this as quickly as they can in Guinea and in some of these other countries in West Africa to try to prevent further transmission.
Donna, can you explain a bit about the symptoms of this virus and the toll it takes on the human body? Because this is a particularly deadly virus to contract.
Yes, absolutely. It is. It is a very deadly virus. The symptoms are quite severe, as we've talked about before. The early symptoms are flu-like, but it progresses fairly quickly into hemorrhaging and organ failure. So basically, a person's organs are just not able often to stand up to the virus. And I hate to be graphic, but in some cases, you know, somewhat dissolve, which leads to a fairly traumatic experience.
So with that in mind, what are the medical charities, the doctors and nurses on the ground in this affected area, what are they doing in terms of treatment?
Well, in terms of a lot of the treatment is really containment in terms of quarantining people and the like. There's no way it is a virus, so nothing that one can give to prevent the transmission of the disease. And some of the countries are doing things in terms of sending out these public health announcements, of telling people not to interact with wild animals, teaching them certain precautions they should take when people and their family or neighbors are sick, in terms of sick or even after they die, because a lot of the transmission is occurring in ritual around burial and those sorts of things. So really taking these various precautions, and if they see these symptoms, trying to seek medical help very quickly.
So there is this suggestion from medical teams in that area that one of the reasons for this fatality rate, this growing death toll, is that a lot of people are refusing to go to hospitals for treatment, instead turning to traditional healers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this is a larger issue of how people in both West Africa, but a lot of Sub-Saharan Africa, view health. Often, not only maybe even avoiding these places, but maybe doing them simultaneously, but often ill people will visit traditional healers either before they go to a biomedical practitioner or during. So absolutely, this is something that one does whenever they're sick, whatever that illness may be. So this is a very ingrained practice.
Donna Patterson, Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Now, Secretary of State John Kerry today demanded Russia proves it's working to disarm separatist militants in eastern Ukraine. Mr. Kerry delivered the ultimatum to Moscow after his meeting with France's foreign minister in Paris. Moscow rejects claims it's directing and arming rebel movements in Ukraine. The US hasn't ruled out additional sanctions if the Kremlin fails to address US and Western concerns over the unrest. However, many Ukrainians remain hopeful that a new age of political stability and transparency can be achieved, along with closer ties to Europe and even improving relations with Russia. Among those optimists are members of the Ukrainian diaspora in the United States. In San Francisco, a non-profit called Nova Ukraine has brought expatriates together to celebrate Ukrainian democracy, but also to pledge their ongoing support and raise money for those injured in the turmoil back home. Rebecca Bowring reports.
Dozens of Ukrainian expatriates, along with Russians and Kazakhs, have gathered in a bar in San Francisco's financial district to eat dumplings, drink champagne, and dance the night away. But behind the revelry is a serious message: the need to help Ukraine build a brighter future. Nova Ukraine is a San Francisco-based non-profit focused on fighting corruption, giving aid to victims of violence, and establishing a civil society. Nick Bielogorski is its CEO and president.
Being here, we're in a unique position to connect the American community with the Ukrainian community and bring in the support from a lot of powerful American individuals, sponsors, raise awareness about Ukraine in the United States. That's a unique thing that we can do here.
As well as speeches and an art auction, there was also traditional Ukrainian folk music at the event. This haunting melody was a reminder of the scores of people who died in the upheaval that gripped Ukraine earlier this year, following the ousting of then-president Viktor Yanukovych. Many more were injured in the Maidan protests. Nova Ukraine was born out of an earlier informal group that held solidarity rallies in San Francisco. It's since donated money to support victims' families, help pay medical costs, and send children to summer camp in Canada. Nick Bielogorski again.
We had one event so far on Golden Gate Bridge, a rally for unity of Ukraine, to symbolize crossing the bridge with Ukrainian flags, symbolize the unity of East and West of Ukraine together. And we also help people register for the elections.
Petro Poroshenko, our new president.
Ukraine's consul general in San Francisco, Sergei Aloshin, also attended, praising the free and fair elections that saw Poroshenko win a decisive victory. San Francisco-based expats were able to vote in that poll. The Bay Area has a thriving Ukrainian community. The country's a hotspot for software programmers, some of whom now work for Silicon Valley companies such as Google and Facebook. Melanie McCutcheon is Ukrainian-American. Many of her relatives still live there.
What I hope for all Ukrainians and my family that lives in Ukraine is that they get to live in a civilized, democratic society where their elected officials really respond to the people. They're not a bunch of oligarchs that are only trying to enrich themselves and steal billions of dollars from Ukrainian taxpayers.
Nova Ukraine supporters will work to establish cultural and educational programs in their homeland, which they say, no matter how far away they may live, remains continually on their minds. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, the air pollution choking Manila, the capital of the Philippines. There's so much talk worldwide about carbon capture, renewable energy, electric cars, and yet enormous amounts of pollutants are pumped into the atmosphere each and every day. And as countries like the Philippines witness economic growth, the situation worsens. More people earning more money drive more cars and consume more fossil fuels, with devastating impacts on public health and the environment. So what's the outlook in Metro Manila? John Vidal, the environment editor of the Guardian newspaper, has been there to find out.
This is Metro Manila, a 12 million strong megalopolis in the Philippines. It's no different from any number of other major cities in Asia. The smell is awful, and the noise makes it almost impossible to talk. In the end, I've had to record this back in a studio so that you can hear me properly. That's how bad it can be. The hospitals here are full of people with respiratory and heart diseases. The latest figures suggest 2 million people in Asia will die prematurely of air pollution this year. The WHO, that's the World Health Organization, now think that 1 in 8 people in the world dies from air pollution. Jeepneys are the most popular form of transport for Manila's poor, but these brightly coloured buses also leave vast plumes of diesel smoke in their wake. David Posadas has lived in the city for years and is a consultant on urban and green issues.
In the Philippines, normally, right now the law says that all vehicles have to be Euro 2 compliant, new vehicles. But the old vehicles, they have a hard time meeting even Euro 1 standards because a lot of the public vehicles are using these rebuilt engines. And so you see a lot of vehicles when they're accelerating, like these jeepneys and these tricycles, you see visible plumes of black smoke or white smoke.
Is that also because the fuel they use has been adulterated, has been smuggled in? What's going on with the fuel?
Because we are an archipelago of 7,100 islands, it's very easy to smuggle in fuel, and there have been reports of that. Aside from that, there's a lot of contaminants in the fuel unless you get it from a reputable gas station. And I guess it's not just in the Philippines, but it's a common pattern in Asia.
But you're a refugee. You now live in a suburb 20 kilometers outside the main city. What happened to your health when you moved outside? Did it improve?
Actually, it's not as bad. It improved, but I was getting a lot of respiratory allergies in the city because you could literally see the pollution coming from the vehicles. You would feel it on your skin, in your face, after a long day of work taking the public transport. A lot of that is really because a lot of these public transport drivers have a hand-to-mouth existence, meaning they probably earn maybe maybe 15 British pounds in a day after a hard day of work. They don't religiously maintain their engines. So you see a lot of engines here that are actually already starting to burn oil.
You're young, and many of the people in the Philippines are very young. We get the impression that it's building up a sort of a public health crisis, which will show itself in 20, 30 years' time as these respiratory diseases become worse and worse. Is that understood in the Philippines, that the air pollution really is a serious problem now?
Originally, I thought only the middle class and the upper middle class understood these things because they were paying for inhalers, you know, the typical bronchodilators and expectorants. But I've also tried to talk to some of these, for example, these jeepney drivers, and I was surprised to learn that they are aware of the risks, and it's like they're caught in a situation where they want to change, but they don't know how.
And because it costs a lot of money to change.
It costs money because if you're running a dilapidated surplus engine, because these public transport conveyances, they don't really get to taste a new engine per se. What they mean by new engine in their case is really a surplus rebuilt engine. So the life of the engine has a limited expectancy, and what they do is to save money, they try to prolong it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the problem occurs.
But you could also say that the life of the human who's driving some of these cars is pretty limited as well.
Yes. I think they're aware of that. But if you're living a hand-to-mouth existence, I think some of them have this fatalistic view on life, meaning if you talk to them about climate change and other, you know, issues about the world, what they'll tell you is, I have to feed my family. And that's what's paramount to them.
And it's not going to get any better. Within 20 years, the Philippines is expected to be using an extra 10 or 15 million cars. That's per year. And there's no sense that the industry, the fuel companies, or the city is able to do anything about it. And that's not even counting the air pollution that comes from factories or homes. The problem is, it's shortening the lives of everyone. Pollution here follows the poor. It's a world problem, but they're breathing most of it.
That's John Vidal, environment editor of The Guardian newspaper. You can read his reporting online at theguardian.com, and you can hear more about global pollution in the paper's Global Development podcast. It's also on the newspaper's website. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, the European country playing a more important role in the region, economically and politically.
Poland has done unusually well over the last 10 years, especially since it joined the EU. Its GDP has grown on average by 4%, and it even managed to avoid a recession after the financial crisis in 2008, when nearly all the other European countries had a recession. Poland continued to grow.
That's Friday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.